If you were to go to any magazine rack in a store where they have them, you quickly find out that the magazines deal with life, whether they're People magazine or magazines about hobbies that people have in life, or even the magazine entitled Life. You'll never see a magazine called Death. I've never seen one, Dying Today. There's People magazine, but there's not Dead People magazine. And it's pretty obvious why. It's kind of a morbid thought, yet we all know that part of life is inevitably death. We know that. We know that one day there's a little plot of ground somewhere on this earth that we're going to be for a very long time. It was Malcolm Muggeridge that said something very classic. He said, "I have one foot in heaven and one foot on earth, and the foot on earth is on a banana peel." See, as soon as we're born, we're on this journey called life, but we're marching toward death, and we never know exactly when our time will be up. There was a little kid that came to his pastor after church. He was sitting in the service that day, and he came up. He was very troubled. He said, "Pastor, today you said that we all come from dust." He said, "Well, that's right." "You also said, if I heard you correctly, that we're all going back to dust." "That's right. You listened well. We are all going back to dust. That's where we came from. That's where we're going. But why are you so troubled, little boy?" And he said, "You got to come to my house quickly and look under my bed, because somebody is either coming or going." You see, the truth is, we don't know if we are coming or going. Are we closer to the day of our birth or the day of our death? Some of us can't answer that. We don't know exactly. And Solomon, in this section, looks at death and life. It's a matter of life and death, but he takes death first in the first few verses, and then life. And what is the best approach to death and life? Basically put, this section, Solomon looks at death as a common destiny for everyone and life as a cheerful activity for those who are wise or righteous and wise. And the way we ought to live is that at the end of our life, there'd be no regrets. We live in such a way so that when we die, people will miss us. And when we look back at the end of our life, we can say, "You know, I made some mistakes, but basically I have no regrets." Now, I've met a lot of people that have a lot of regrets as they look back. "Oh, I wish I would have done this," or "I wish I had it all to do over again." Three guys were friends. They died in a car crash all at the same time, and they were in heaven. It was orientation. And so the guy, whoever it is in these stories, comes up to him and says, "Okay, now at your funeral, when all your friends and your relatives are gathered around the casket and you're lying in it, what would you like to hear them say about you?" First guy said, "Well, I suppose I'd like him to say that I was a great doctor and I was a good family man." Second guy said, "I'd like to hear them say that I was a father who loved his children, a husband that loved his wife, and a teacher that made a difference in the life of children." He said to the third guy, "What about you?" He said, "I think I'd like to hear them say, 'Look, he's moving.'" I would say this guy had some regrets if he would say that. Because I'll tell you this, when it's my time to go, let me go. I know where I'm going. I'm going to be in God's presence. So don't pray me back. If you do, I'll haunt you. In chapter 9, the first six verses, Solomon speaks about this common destiny called death. And he says a few things about death. First thing he mentions, and it's a piggyback thought from the previous chapter, is that both death and life, we don't know when that will be, but God has those dates firmly in His hands. If you go back to chapter 8, look at verse 7. Solomon says, "For man doesn't know what will happen, Who can tell him when it will occur? No one has power over the Spirit to retain the Spirit. And no one has power in the day of death. There is no release from that war. Verse 17, Solomon says, "Then I saw all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun." Then in chapter 9, verse 1, "For I considered all this in my heart, so that I could declare it all, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. People know neither love nor hatred by anything that they see before them." Here on this earth, as a creation of God, we don't know what's in the mind of the Creator. God does, we don't. So the best we can do is live wisely, righteously in the will of God, knowing that our days, our times are in God's hands. God knew when you would be born. God knows when you'll die, and He knows all of the events that happened between those two very important dates. It was Corrie Ten Boom who used to say, "I don't know what the future holds, but I know who holds the future." And it's a great place to rest when we can place our head, so to speak, on the pillow of God's sovereignty. My life is in God's hands. I trust my future to Him. You might say the future is your friend when Jesus is your Lord. And when Jesus is your Lord, you think, "Well, Lord, I don't know what's going to happen, but You know what's going to happen. I'm going to live for You because this might be the last day I live." And that helps me have a light touch with this world. That's how we ought to live. Be responsible, but have a light touch because it's not your permanent home. Remember the guy that Jesus talked about in the Gospels? Very wealthy guy. He had so much stuff, he didn't know what to do with it. And so he said, "What shall I do with all my goods?" And he said, "I know what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns. I'll build bigger barns." That night, God said, "You fool, tonight your soul is required of you." Sometime back, I was flying from somewhere to somewhere else. I don't really remember. But I was in an airport. That I do remember. And I think it was Los Angeles Airport. It might have been another airport. But they had just redecorated the airport, but they forgot the bathroom. Or they were going to do that next. But I remember going into the bathroom out of this beautifully redecorated lobby and thinking, "Boy, this place is shabby in here. You know, they ought to do this and they ought to put this up." And I'm thinking how to redecorate the bathroom. And it sort of dawned on me, this is dumb. I'm not going to be here very long. Moments. And then I'm going to leave and go somewhere else. It's not my destination. It's foolish to think about redecorating bathrooms when you don't live in one. And that's what this earth is like. This earth, we're in transit. We're in the lounge. And it might look pretty cool. Oh, there's some nice places here and there. But why worry too much about redecorating bathrooms when we're on our way somewhere else called eternity? And just to realize my life, my death, my birth, all of the events are in God's hands. It's a great place to rest. In verse 2, Solomon continues this development of thought and says that no matter who you are, death is a respecter of no man, no woman. He says, "All things come alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the clean, the unclean, to him who sacrifices, that is to him who goes to the temple and brings his little lamb to sacrifice, to him who doesn't." So whether you're a churchgoer or not a churchgoer, you're clean spiritually or you're defiled spiritually, one event happens to all. It's called death. "As is the good, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath is he who fears an oath." No matter if you're a billionaire or you're in poverty, if you're young, if you're old, if you're the president or you didn't vote, one event happens to everyone called death. Take a look around at everyone in this room. Just kind of look and see who's here. And then the next time you look at television or a movie, notice the people in the movie. All those movie stars and all the people that won the Grammys and music. Realize that in 100 years, everyone you see will have vanished. Not one person will be left. unless they're very young and they live to a very, very ripe old age. Everyone would be gone. And that's a sobering but a very healthy thing to do from time to time, is to look around and realize every person is going to die. 1.975 people die every second, almost 2 people a second. 102 every minute. 6,136 every hour die. Which, because of the population in our world, is posing a problem. Where do we put them all? You say, what do you mean? They're dead. Well, that's just the point. Governments in the world are now realizing that we don't have enough earth in the places where people live to bury people. So that in Brazil, one architect came up with this skyscraper cemetery. According to his plans, it'll be 39 stories with a capacity of 147,000 people, dead people. So you can drive by and say, that's where all the dead people live, in that skyscraper. But death will have the last word. Death is no respecter of persons, young, old, rich, poor, clean, unclean, sacrificing, unsacrificing, everyone dies. Now, having said that, that's pretty obvious. Though death is no respecter of persons, dying is. I think it was Woody Allen who said, I'm not afraid of death, I just don't want to be there when it happens. But of course you will. And you will die well or not well. You're all going to die, but how will you die? You see, people die differently. Death is no respecter of persons, dying is. When Jesus was on the cross, there was a thief on either side of him. And they both died very differently. One died an unbeliever, one died a believer. One died blaspheming Christ, angry, mad, in despair. The other thief heard those gracious words from Jesus, today you will be with me in paradise. He died very differently from the other guy. Or compare a couple of people back in the 1700s, contemporaries. One was Voltaire, the famous unbeliever, atheist. Very aggressive atheist. In fact, he said of Jesus Christ, curse the wretch. That's what he said of Christ, curse him. Then he said, with my single hand, within 20 years, I will dismantle all that it took the 12 disciples to raise, meaning the church. That's what he said arrogantly in life, but his death was very different than his life. Well, he lived in despair, and he died in despair, actually. When he died, the nurse who attended his death said, for all the money in Europe, I will not attend the death of another atheist, ever. Because when he died, for hours he was crying out in despair. He said, oh Christ, oh Jesus Christ, I'm abandoned by God and by man. I shall go to hell. And cried out for hours in that kind of agony. Now compare his death with his contemporary, John Wesley, the evangelist, who with great peace in his heart said, and the best of all is that God is with us. And he died. Or compare Mahatma Gandhi, great leader. But it's interesting, he said that he found more solace in the Indian writings, the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads, than even the words of Jesus Christ in the Sermon on the Mount. And yet when he died, he said his last words, I find myself in a slough of despond. For the first time in 50 years, all about me is darkness. I am praying for light. But now listen to the words of a contemporary, Dwight L. Moody, the evangelist from Chicago. He was dying and he looked up with a smile and he said, earth is receding, heaven is opening, and I hear God calling. Yes, death is no respecter of persons, but dying is, and the destination is. The destination is. Everybody dies, goes to the grave, but after that, you live forever. Only two things live forever, the Word of God and the human soul. And dying and destination are respecter of persons. I've told you before about that very interesting gravestone in Indiana in the cemetery. It has a poem written on it. It says, pause, stranger, as you pass me by. As you are now, so once was I. As I am now, so you will be. So prepare for death and follow me. Some brave visitor wrote his own message next to the gravestone that said, "To follow you, I'm not content until I know which way you went." We're all going to end up there, but what about afterwards? Where did you went is the issue. The third thing he says about death here is that death is greatly misunderstood by a lot of folks. In verse 3, he goes down to the level of the unbeliever. It's the perspective of the humanist. He says, "This is an evil that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live. And after that they go to the dead. But for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love, their hatred, their envy have now perished. Never more will they have share in anything that is done under the sun." This is the perspective of the unbeliever concerning death, and it is a wrong perspective. It's amazing how misinformed people are about death, the future. Even some Christians, I meet Christians who, you know, say things like, "Well, my pet's going to be with me in heaven," or "People that die will be turned into angels after death," or they believe that the body, the soul, actually goes into this suspended stasis until the Lord comes back and there's no consciousness. Greatly misinformed. There was a family that went to the beach and they're having a good time until the four-year-old boy came up to dad and said, "You got to come see this." Grabbed his hand and took him over to a dead seagull on the beach. I don't know if you've ever seen one of those. After the surf is washed, it looks pretty gnarly. He looked down and said, "What happened, Daddy?" The daddy tried to couch it in comforting terms for the child. He said, "The bird died and went to heaven." And the boy looked at it for a while and pondered and said, "And so God threw him back down?" I mean, he looked pretty bad. Well, we don't do much better sometimes than that. Sometimes we're very misinformed when it comes to death and the future. The view of the unbeliever in verse 3 is that death ends it all. After death, there's nothing, no consciousness. That death is hopeless, verse 4. "You have hope while you're alive. Better to be a live dog than a dead lion," even though in life the lion would be stronger. And that there is no awareness, verse 5, no consciousness after death, no emotion, no feeling. If you are that misinformed about death, that will do something to the way you and I live. If for you life is it here, and that death ends it all, then that will show up in your life. You will do everything you can to preserve your life now and not prepare for the future. This is it. Better have a good time. This is the last good time I'm going to have. If you were around in the 60s, I was a small child during that time, but I remember Timothy Leary, the guru, the LSD guru of the 60s, told everybody to take pot, take LSD, turn on, etc. Gave people a fresh perspective of life. A few years ago, he was dying, and he is dead now. And he joked about his death. He said, "Oh, listen, I want it to be televised. It's public. It's a group event, a team event." And he said that he would be cryonically frozen and preserved so that when technology reaches the point where they can thaw him out, he can live again. But a close friend who was interviewed of Timothy Leary said, quote, "Even though he joked about death, he is as afraid of dying as any of us." His friend went on to say, "Maybe even more so, because he really doesn't believe there is anything that comes after this." Well, people like that are then afraid to die. They want to preserve life. But you see, that's a misunderstanding. The Bible speaks about death very different. It doesn't say death ends it all. It's just the beginning, really. You think about living 80 years here on earth, maybe, to 160 years, 2,000 years, 50 billion years, eternity. Death doesn't end it all. It's just the beginning. Also, the Bible doesn't indicate that there's hopelessness in death, but hope, if you're a believer, great hope. And the Bible doesn't say that you cease to exist and you have no consciousness, no awareness, no emotion. You're very aware, you're very conscious, and you can feel things. Remember, Jesus told a story. It wasn't a parable, it was a story about a rich man and Lazarus. Both died. One went to Hades, one went to Abraham's bosom. One was tormented, one was comforted. And the one who was tormented said, "I am tormented by these flames. Send me some comfort." And he was aware of things that were going on. When Paul spoke about the possibility of his own death, when he was writing to the Philippians from a Roman prison, he talked about dying as departing to be with Christ, which is far better. And after that, he said, "For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain." So that was his perspective, very different from this unbelieving perspective. His perspective is there's hope after the grave, there's consciousness after the grave, and death doesn't end at all. It's just the beginning. I'll be with Christ. Far better. It's far better. Now, I heard about a lawyer who was on his deathbed. I know we like to pick on lawyers, but face it, they're an easy target. The lawyer was on his deathbed, and he turned to his wife and he said, "Get me the Bible." Well, she thought this was a good sign because he never asked for the Bible before. She was religious, he was not. She grabbed the Bible and started opening it up to a familiar text to bring him comfort. Well, he grabbed the Bible out of her hands and started thumbing through the pages, and his eyes were darting back and forth. And she said, "Honey, what are you doing?" And he shouted out, "Looking for loopholes." Well, it's too late at that point. And if you study the Bible rather than quickly glance at it before death, if you study it and submit to it and know the God of the Bible, you don't have to look for loopholes. You're prepared for death. Now, in verse 7, there is a shift. He stops talking about death and he talks about life. It's a counterbalance to what he has spoken about in the first few verses. You know, you can only take so much musing about death. So he says, "Go, eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white, your head lack no oil. Live joyfully with a wife whom you love all the days of your vain," or short, uncertain life on earth, "which he has given you under the sun, all your days of vanity. For that is your portion in life. And in the labor in which you perform under the sun, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going." Notice the first word in verse 7 is the word "go." That's a good word after you're thinking about death. You can just picture. The guy reads the first few verses and really thinks about it, and he's sitting there musing over the insoluble mysteries of life and death. How long will I live? Death could come at any moment, and that could be a morbid place to be. So he says, "Go. Quit musing about death. Quit sighing about the uncertainty of life. Get up and live. And not just live, but live joyfully." There's a lot of cheer built into these verses. Live cheerfully. Enjoy the gift of life that God has given you. Now, these verses, all the ancient rabbis say, were spoken to the righteous person, the wise person, as is mentioned in verse 1. So, get on with life. That's a good word for a lot of us today. Some of us may be in a spot where we're uncertain about a diagnosis from the doctor. We're uncertain about a relative. And our life has just sort of slowed down. Go, live, enjoy the gift God has given you. Make it the best. There was an ant who was talking to a centipede. And the ant asked a very interesting question to the centipede. The ant said to the centipede, "How do you know which leg to move next?" That's a good question. There's 100 of them. "How do you know which leg to move next?" And the centipede said, "I've never thought about it before." But then he started thinking about it. He pondered it. And he got confused and so perplexed, He forgot how to move. There's a lot of people like that. Get so bogged down with the complexities, the insoluble issues of life, death, the future, even theologically bogged down, that they fail to move forward. They don't seize the opportunities that are there in the present. Move on with your life. The issue isn't how long you'll live or counting your years, but making your years count, living well, living joyfully, placing God at the center of your life. That's implicit in all of these verses. If you go back now to verse 7, he says that we should have joy in four areas of our life. Notice them. Verse 7, add joy to your meals. Go eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Now, eating and drinking, these are the basic things in life. And in ancient times, meals were not lavish, but they were family-oriented. You know, we eat on the run. We'll grab a burger on the way to someplace. But a meal was very communal. Get up in the morning, have a snack, about 10 to 12, somewhere in there, they'd have a brunch. They'd go out and work the rest of the day till sunset. They'd all gather back and have a very simple dinner together. Usually bread and wine, that's the common staple. Maybe some cheese, some vegetables. Meat was an expensive commodity. It was rarely used, but it was used from time to time. So the idea is this. You don't know when the last day of your life is going to be. You don't know when the last meal you're going to have is going to be. So eat your bread, drink your wine with joy, a merry heart. Add joy to your meals. Solomon, when he ate, he just didn't eat bread and wine. He had a feast. He had a banquet. But the scripture would indicate that though Solomon had the wealthiest kind of banquet, he didn't always enjoy his meals. It seems there was strife because there's at least three times where the book of Proverbs says something to this effect. Better is a dry crust of bread with peace and quiet than a house full of feasting with strife. And you get the idea that Solomon is speaking autobiographically. Well, you know, 300 wives, 700 concubines and all the servants. It's like a crust of bread, please, little peace and quiet. The most important thing you can add to your family meals is love. Love. Family love. And we don't want to spend too long on this, but let me just add a suggestion. To have a joyful mealtime, don't allow complaining. Make it a rule. Somebody starts to complain, we'll have none of that here. We're enjoying a meal together. Talk about the day, hash through things, but keep it on a positive note, an edifying note. You heard about the father who was a Christian and he had his family at the table and he prayed, oh God, we thank you. You're so good. You're so kind. You're so gracious. You provided this food. Then he ate it and he started complaining. Honey, you didn't cook this right. And why did you cook that this way? Where's the So his wife came out and slugged him. No, I'm just kidding. The little child at the table, the very perceptive son said, Daddy, did God just hear you when you prayed? He said, of course.
God hears us when we pray. He always hears us when we pray.
I thought so. Now, Daddy, did God just hear you complain to Mommy? Well, I suppose he did. Well, which did God believe, Daddy? The first part or the second part? Second thing Solomon would say about this life is that we should add joy to our routines. Verse 8, let your garments always be white, let your head lack no oil. Keep in mind, in those days, life was pretty tough. Garments were pretty simple. And the only thing they put on their faces wasn't expensive cologne, but a thing called olive oil to refresh the face. But every now and then, there was a special occasion that called for the best garments and the best perfume. A wedding, a family reunion. And they'd put on the best clothes, and they'd put on the sweetest smelling perfume. And they would go on through the night. They would make it the best occasion they could because there were so few of these occasions. The idea in verse 8 then, Solomon is saying, is make every occasion a special occasion because it might be your last. Might be the last time. Remember, Paul said in Philippians how often we should rejoice in the Lord. Rejoice in the Lord. Always. Always. And again, I say rejoice. And you might think, yeah, well, that's easy for you to say, Paul. You're just writing a letter. But he wrote it from a Roman prison. Third, add joy to your marriage, Solomon would indicate, verse 9. Notice the words, live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your life. Not live grudgingly. Not go ahead and put up with your wife all the days of your life. And yet, marriage often deteriorates into this. I've seen enough marriages to know that marriage can be heaven on earth or hell on earth. There's not a lot of middle ground. It can be fulfilling. It should be fulfilling. You have to work at it for that to happen. It's a constant maintenance process. But life is way too short to allow the most intimate of relationships to sour and deteriorate. It's worth everything to keep it operating at peak. Now, how do you do that? How do you add joy to a marriage? Again, I don't want to spend too long a time here because of lack of time, but let me just give you four quick elements. Number one, Christ-centeredness. Christ-centeredness. And this isn't just a little spiritual thing to throw in because pastors should say that. Seriously, the husband and wife, when they're rightly related to Jesus Christ, that's the foundation. Not, well, we believe in a higher power. See the plaque on the wall? Christ is the unseen guest at every meal. Oh, big deal. I want a seen guest at every meal where you can see Christ living in a person. Christ-centeredness. Second would be committed love. Committed love. There's a difference between we'll tolerate each other and committed love. There's going to be storms in a marriage, in any life. They're going to come. That is definite. That's why you need to be committed till death do us part. The storms are going to come, yes. Don't have an escape clause in your relationship. Well, I'll love you till, well, you get ugly, and I get ugly, and our feelings change. You know, dude. No, we're committed forever. Third, communication. Communication. So important to try to understand your spouse. And I know we can say, you know, I just don't understand women. We'll try a little harder and nurture in that understanding that other person's feelings. Fourth, I would call it clemency. Clemency. Be nice. Be nice. Be gentle. Be merciful. Be humble. Say you're sorry. You know, it's very easy to start an argument. It takes one person to stop it. Say you're sorry. Humble yourself. What can I do to change? Well, but I'm right. Yeah, but you want to live joyfully, right? So humble yourself. For marriage to last a lifetime, for marriage to have staying power, it needs the important ingredient of joy. It needs that. Without it, it won't last. You got to work at keeping it in there sometimes. Now, there was an older couple who went to McDonald's. And a young guy was watching this. The older couple came in, ordered one meal, a Big Mac, fries, and one Coke, one Happy Meal, you know, and an extra cup. And the elderly gentleman cut the hamburger right in half, separated it for his wife and for him, took the French fries and did this, one, two, one, three, just separated every one so each had half, took half the Coke, poured it in the glass. Then the older guy started eating his meal, and his wife just sat there, hands folded, watching him. Well, the young man thought, this is a very poor couple, and offered to buy them another meal so they wouldn't have to split it. The older guy said, oh no, nothing's wrong. We've been married now for 50 years, and we always split everything down the middle. We share everything we have 50-50. He thought, oh, that's very sweet, very romantic. Then he turned to the woman and said, but he's eating, why aren't you eating? And she said, it's his turn to use the teeth. Listen, you got to hand it to that couple. I mean, that's committed. That's committed love. When you're that close. Okay, well, let's move on, shall we? Look at the end of verse 9, into verse 10, and we'll close with this. Add joy to your career. Some of us really need to hear this one. He says, and in the labor in which you perform under the sun, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. Tomorrow you're going back to work. You're going to do some stuff, and some of you like your jobs, some of you hate your jobs. You know, our careers have the potential to reach the level of boredom very rapidly, although we might love it at first. A person might say, I love my job. When did you get it? Last week. It's really great. So fulfilling. I love the people. Interview that person in a year, a few months. I hate this lousy job. Or the person who has a hobby, like tuning up cars, likes to tinker. And then he decides to open up a business, an auto shop. Now it's no longer a hobby, but he has to do it. He has clients who demand. The fun is out of it. And it can deteriorate quickly. We can lose joy quickly. The quickest way to add joy to your job, remember this tomorrow, is to add Christ to your job. You might say, I have a lousy boss. So what? Do it for Christ. Oh, this is so boring, but do it for His glory. Listen to what Paul writes, Colossians chapter 3, verse 23. Work hard and cheerfully at whatever you do, as though you were working for the Lord rather than for people. You know, if you and I went to work Monday morning with that attitude, we would change drudgery into ministry. We'd have a whole different, joyful outlook. I can do this for God in worship. Billy Sunday said, if you have no joy in your religion, speaking to Christians, there must be a leak somewhere in your Christianity. In verse 7, he says, God already accepted your works. He's speaking to a righteous person. From a New Testament perspective, you are accepted in Jesus Christ if you've received Him. You're accepted. Oh, you blow it from time to time, but you're His. You're in Christ. You ought to live well. Man, you ought to live joyfully. You ought to live well. You ought to die well. You're living right now, and you're dying right now. How are you living? Well, are you ready to die? Are you prepared for death? When that banana peel slips, and it will, then what? Is Christ the center of your life today? I love what C.S. Lewis said. He said, joy is the serious business of heaven. A great way to put it, the serious business of heaven. It ought to be the serious business of believers.